Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's episode, I am joined by winemaker Steve Mathiasen. We're going to go through some of the cliches that have attached themselves to different wine regions around the world and discuss whether or not those are deserved or if those are actually even helping. You know, they have to grow sweet wine, they can only grow a certain kind of wine or a certain kind of grape. Very interesting stuff. Before we get to our conversation, I want to remind everybody that on SOM TV, our brand new film, Cup of Salvation, streams February 23rd on SOM TV with hours of bonus features. So you want to make sure if you're not a member of SOM TV, go to SOMTV.com and sign up. This is a film we're very proud of and cannot wait for you to see it, especially with all the things we made that go around it. I want to remind all of you, go to SOMTV.com and check out the 2022 Napa Valley Vintage Report. We are streaming a brand new episode that takes an in-depth look at the 2022 vintage in Napa Valley. We are joined by some of the great winemakers in Napa, and they go through barrel tastings, and we take a look at how is this vintage shaping up right now. So you'll want to go to SOMTV.com to stream that right now. Without further ado, my conversation with Steve Mathiasen. Steve, it's an honor to have you back on the podcast. I've missed you. You know that the listeners have missed you.
Well, I've missed you. And I've missed the listeners.
Good, that's good. Well, I have you on. You know, you're sort of a quiet anarchist up there in Napa. You're doing stuff that is not traditional. You know, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing in Napa. And we all know what you're supposed to be doing in Napa. So on this podcast, you and I talked about the typecasting of regions, how certain regions just become known for grape, a style of wine, and to the surprise of a lot of people who dig deeper, there's a lot more going on in those regions, but also the potential that maybe they're growing the wrong thing, which is a real hot take. So I want to start with your perspective on the wine world and how regions like this get typecasted, how it happens that there's a style that they grow, there's a grape variety that they grow, there is a way they do it. And I don't mean like monks doing it for 1,000 years. I'm talking about the commercial aspects. So where do we start on this?
Yeah, I mean, the wine world is so freaking complicated, right? And so a lot of times people are just lucky to even find out the name of a region. And so you can totally see how people would find out that a region does something. Like everyone knows Burgundy makes Pinot Noir. And so it's like, hey, but when I say everybody, a lot of people don't know that, right? And so there's a level of wine education. It's like where you figure out, there's this place called Burgundy and they make a grape variety called Pinot Noir. So now I'm on my way to like knowing something about wine. But then you scratch and you're like, well, they actually make Chardonnay. They actually make Aligoté. There's all these subregions. The wines actually taste different. And that's like next level stuff, right? But then that's a famous region. Well, so you figured that out, but then you're looking at Vino Verde and that's three levels past, that's like 4D chess kind of stuff, where it's like, oh, Vino Verde has not just bubbly wine, but really high quality still wine, and even has a red wine tradition. You know, I found that out this year after 30 years in the industry. I had no clue.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, a lot of people who listen to this podcast probably are a lot more advanced than, say, somebody shopping at Trader Joe's for a bottle of wine or something. But for the most part, Portuguese wines like Vino Verde are not exactly, you know, market penetration's a lot lower than, say, French wine, I would imagine, at least. Mm-hmm. And so you have that problem. And that problem is going to be, I don't know that problem is ever going to go away. You know, the barrier for entry on this stuff. But what I think is really fascinating in the way that you fit into this topic, you know, you and I have both traveled around the entire world, drank a lot of wines, been surprised in a lot of places. There are these cliches that we're going to talk about on today's podcast, like sweet Riesling in Germany or port wine in Portugal, or especially the Douro Valley, or a certain kind of wine made in Bordeaux or a certain kind of wine made in Napa. Those cliches do exist. I mean, they really do. And I want to start, before we get into what those are, identifying them and maybe breaking them down a little bit. Don't the majority of them just exist because it's easier to sell a wine saying like, look, this is what we do and we do it well here, you know, Malbec in Argentina or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm going to grow something wildly different, it's harder to market it. So this conversation has to be attached to marketing, right?
Yeah, I think so. And you get a lot of these regions have had like, you know, really uber successful marketers that sort of like got up there and elevated a region around whatever that they in particular, their what they were selling, basically, right? And, you know, these charismatic people that stepped up and defined a region, you'll find that. But it's also, I think, just on the wine consumer side of you're just lucky to even remember the name of this obscure region, let alone to know what all they do there, other, you know, past the obvious stuff.
I was going to say, with the typecasting thing, what is like the main region you would say comes to your mind as the example of a region being typecasted for something that it either fairly or unfairly gets?
Oh, well, I mean, the first thing that is that caused us to think of the topic was Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yes. My favorite topic.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, that would be example of what you were talking about. If you have a smaller number of producers, a few in particular that have a created something that was really successful, but you have all these other people doing other stuff, more traditional stuff, that drown under the anonymity of that typecasting.
But in the same thing, it's like you have this double-edged sword. Beaujolais Nouveau was created and it put Beaujolais sort of on the international map, right? Or sort of. I mean, I think for the most part before, you know, most Americans still have a hard time saying the word Beaujolais. It's not an easy word to spell. But without Beaujolais Nouveau, it might be, you know, like the Languedoc. It might just be sort of like you don't know it exists if you're American. You might, even if you drink the wines or not. So it's this double-edged sword that I think some of the best wines in Europe come from Beaujolais. But of course, I'm speaking about Cru Beaujolais. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows my over-dramatized feelings about Beaujolais Nouveau. I'm not a fan. But I love Cru Beaujolais, and I love Beaujolais as a place. I mean, I love the food there. I love the topography. I love the people. It is an it's like a number one place to visit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That being said, you're right. It's like five producers who made Beaujolais Nouveau what it is.
You know, like I've had some really delicious Beaujolais Nouveau, but there's so much more to the region, obviously, right? That's the whole thing. There's so much more to the region. And the why do we care besides as a consumer, your people aren't getting at that more that's so cool and has history and vision and all the great things we like about wine. But also, it's, you know, you Beaujolais managed to survive this one, I think, for the most part. But these regions, it's like, you know, we're going to lose the people that get lost because they don't have a place with the typecasting.
Sure. Well, I mean, for me, it's so easy to think of your perspective on Napa. I don't know how you've done it. You, your wife, your team, all of you that do Matthias and Vineyards, you don't do what I think is typically known of Napa. And I think now, I don't mean to be mean or crass or anything, but I think now Napa land is so expensive that you kind of have to aim for how do I make an expensive, bigger, big fruity, most often Cabernet type wine. And you don't do that in particular. So there are ways to break out of this. I mean, when people think of Napa from your perspective, what is the idea of Napa? You know, I know yours is different. You walk a certain walk, but what is the idea of Napa?
Yeah, because the modern this is the typecasting idea, is that we're talking about oaky fruit bombs, right? And so some people like that, some people don't. And the people that like it, like, bring it on. And the people that don't are like, well, I'm not interested. When in reality, the idea of Napa is this amazing place to grow grapes, wonderful soils and climate, a great tradition, and 700 wineries that don't all taste the same. But that's not initially apparent. If you were to back up and just look at the region by region, you think, oh, well, everything from Napa is going to be. So we get all the time, like, your wines aren't like high alcohol, and they're not really like jammy and fruity and oaky, you know, but you're in Napa, what gives? And so I get that a lot. And it's like, we actually have a climate that allows us to also make elegant, restrained wines that still have a lot of flavor, but it's a different side of the Cabernet variety. It's more savory, more, you know, earthy, mineral, you know, but then it requires that education with that person. And that's just over and over again, because normal level of wine education, Napa means one thing, Sonoma means one thing. The struggle that is part of wine regions is getting out from under that typecasting of like what people expect from the region.
Well, I know that this can go even deeper than this, because when you were mentioning Burgundy earlier, now look, Burgundy, I promise you could grow a lot more than just Pinot and Chardonnay in those main regions. Why would you do that when you can get the money you can for those grapes?
Yeah.
And on top of it, it's really good. I mean, you and I both love Burgundy. It's out of my tax bracket often, but I know that Burgundy as a whole is trying to shed that label of everything's very expensive. They're trying to. Mm-hmm. They're working nonstop to say, look, the Macon is there, Cote Chalonnaise is there, all these places where you can find wines that are good and affordable. But they're sort of in an interesting subgenre of being typecasted that now it's like they have to be expensive or you're supposed to pay a lot of money. You're not mm-hmm. allowed to go there trying to discover new stuff. And though it might all be Pinot and Chardonnay, there's a lot of different examples of it. So, I mean, this goes vertically, not just like a grape or a wine. Sometimes it's basically just what the reputation of an entire region is. So Burgundy's mm-hmm. stacked on like the fact that they grow Pinot. Do you think Pinot and Chardonnay, should they be growing anything else? I mean, these laws that we don't have here that they have there are also contributing to this type of an idea.
Yeah, exactly. And the laws kind of create a tradition and it gets put in other areas, mm-hmm. you know. And so, I mean, I would, if I had a vineyard in Burgundy, I would be like, I wonder how Rebola Jolla does in Burgundy. I bet awesome. Yeah,
you know? I can only imagine. If you were in Burgundy and you were... I mean, there's no question the villagers in Merceau would come with pitchforks and kick you out.
Oh my God, right? But you know, the old tradition was they had these field blend mixed blocks in Burgundy, mm-hmm. and I just think that's really cool. Like you know, like the first thing I would do, I'm going to say half kidding about Rebola. I would like to try Rebola Jolla in Burgundy. I think it would be amazing the minerality it would give. But the first thing I would want to do is go back to an old school pre-law field blend. I think that would be so interesting. You know, there's a few folks here. I don't know if you've ever, I can't remember if Greg LaFollette's been on the podcast, but he
was in the second Somm film, Greg LaFollette.
Yeah. So he's done a lot of work on researching the original field blend. And he uses some of that in his own winemaking, you know, like, you know, the Pinot Gris or Aligoté in with the Pinot Noir because they bring tannin and they bring, you know, texture in a really cool way.
Interesting. I've always, a lot of red wines that are co-fermented with white wines or white grapes, I think are tremendous. I wish it was being mm-hmm. done more. But then you run into the problem, especially like, what do you call that wine? And what you started the conversation off with is the education is a huge barrier. I mean, for me to say, you want to go to an Argentine steakhouse? We're going to sit down and get a bottle of wine. 9 times out of 10, they're going to give you some Malbec. That has nothing to do with the fact that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other kind of wines grown in Argentina. But it's just easier.
It's exactly. And so
it's just easier.
It's just easier, especially if you're one of the big Malbec houses that has enough wine to export to a steakhouse in the U.S. But then, you know, right. you're doing an exciting Cabernet Sauvignon, really savory in Argentina, which I've had. And you're like pounding sand trying to get anybody in the U.S. to take an Argentinian cab seriously. And, it's, you know, that would be a classic example.
Yeah, well, this is the other thing. And I think in order to sell a wine, I mean, tell me the truth here, just you and I. Have you ever gotten into an argument with your wife because you grow Rebola Gialla?
An argument, no. But we did replant a section a few years back, and she was like, "What do you want to replant?" And I said, "Well, you know, the Sciopatino is so poor producing. I was thinking that we should plant more Sciopatino." And she responds, "Well, if it's so poor producing, why are you replanting?" I thought that was very logical, right? It's poor producing, so we need more of it. So we have enough Sciopatino. And she's like, "If it's so poor producing, why are you planting more of it?" And I was like, "Huh? That's why you're in charge of this business, not me."
Yeah, this is Sciopatino. I mean, like, you think about like Napa and Sonoma and these regions, and you're doing Rebola Gialla and Sciopatino. I mean, like, they don't make them like you anymore, Steve. I mean, now what you find is like, yeah, we do a big Cabernet, but we practice regenerative farming. And you're like, oh, there okay, you go. So that's the difference now. But like, you know, it's
which that is good though. But yes,
that is very good. But I mean, it's like, it's no longer, the marketing stuff is no longer like, here is this grape, here is this wine you haven't tried. You know, we're blending Rhone style this or that. It's more of like, yeah, it's the same thing, but we grow it differently. The same thing, mm-hmm. but we have this certification or whatever.
Trust me, it'll taste exactly like you're expecting, but but we're a values-driven company.
That's right. That's right. I mean, so it's easy for us to like hawk on this, and some regions are very different than others. I mean, you know, if you look at Germany has this, and I know they're trying to shed this. They are always trying to shed that all their wines are sweet. But there's this idea that the Riesling, I mean, this is a Riesling great problem, not just Germany, but that Germany does like sweet Rieslings, right? Which I love, by the way. I actually enjoy these wines, especially with age. They're tremendous. So
we made a sweet Riesling this year. We got some fruit from Sinski.
Oh, really?
And we decided to do like a cabinet style with 40 grams of sugar. It's and crazy acid. It's fucking awesome.
That's
so
amazing.
Fun. Yeah. And so, and that would be, you know, well, the irony is everyone expects a California Riesling to be dry.
Right. Yeah. <you're> like, like you're doing like Smith Madrone's Riesling or something like that. But like, so the question is how, and this goes right back, how do you sell it? How do you sell a Napa Riesling? Does that just go straight to your wine club? Is that something
that's going to have to go to the wine club? Because you kidding me? We have a hard enough time selling Napa. Well, we don't have a hard time selling Napa Robola Jolla, but we did have a hard time selling it. And, yeah, that was a tricky one because it was like, well, what do people expect? And I was like, I'm pretty sure they're not going to expect it to have screaming acid and residual sugar. So we had to, you know, we don't normally put operating instructions on our labels. We just kind of tell you what it, you know, is this Riesling, what the vineyard is. But we had to come up with like, you know, we called it semi-dry just so people at least have some, before they open it, they could think about what they're going to pair it with and be expecting that it's going to be a sweeter wine.
You're making me wonder if there are examples of winemakers in a region that have bucked the kind of like what they're supposed to do besides you. And there are a few others in Napa who are trying this, but you are like always my first of mind. I mean, you know, Schioppettino. I don't know of anyone else growing at Napa. There might be. You might have some weird club you go to on Tuesday nights. Can you think around the world of a winemaker in a region that is now very successful that bucked a trend? That figured out how and just said, we're going to do something different. I'm not doing what my region is known for.
So like in Portugal, Luís Seabra would be a kindred spirit, you know, doing beautiful white wines in the Douro and also like really balanced like 12 and a half alcohol red wines from the Douro with indigenous varieties, doing textured, beautiful whites from Vino Verde. You go region by region, and that's what that's what we're always seeking out. That's what makes it so, in every region we're like, okay, who here is trying to get back to the old ways or trying to progress into a, you know, path through whatever this, the dominant paradigm of like, you know, score-driven winemaking or export-driven winemaking or, you know, more commodity orientation and do real legitimate wine in that region. You know, like, so like Beaujolais would be a great example that like, now it's, you know, the like Kermit Lynch with his gang of four. I mean, those, you know, that was huge. And he was tireless at promoting and telling the story for people to understand these really legitimate wines that were getting made there. You know, Foyard and La Pierre.
Yeah. And those wines are formidable in me figuring out that I truly loved this world. I mean, for real. Mm-hmm. Like I remember having La Pierre for the first time and going, just having my mind blown by how good it was. And, you know, it had some age on it. I'd never tasted anything like it. You know, never.
Yeah.
I thought it was stupendous. Now it's, of course, it was so inexpensive then. And now
you get a bottle for like $18 or something like that.
For real. It really was. It was like, might've been 16, but now it's not, sadly. This is the other thing that happens. I also like the inverse of this too, where like, say a region like, you know, like Bulgari, where they do like Sesicaia or Super Tuscans, where it's like they're bucking a big trend and blending international French grapes into their wine, but they're doing it to be like Bordeaux or doing it to be like, and that's interesting because it's like you're bucking a typecast, but then you're also, you're kind of like re-typecasting yourself. It's almost like
creating a new typecast. And so now in Bulgari, someone who's trying to do like a 13% kind of pale Sangiovese has to fight for a place.
That's right.
But that's why for me as a wine lover, I'd be like, okay, well, clearly Bulgari is an awesome place to grow grapes. Because the thing about the Super Tuscans is it's like Napa Cab. It's not easy to make wine with that much power. And so you're like, okay, if you can't do that everywhere. And so it's like, okay, well, if a region that does that, then it's like, well, who here is doing more elegant wines? I want to try that. That's like my wine geekery is to get in. Barolo would be another example. like, you know, we were there and we were like searching around and we found Principiano and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, 13% alcohol Nebbiolo. It reminds me structure wise of the ones from the, you know, 70s. So cool. And then you find out that they're farming organically and doing all this wildlife habitat and bird habitat. And it's like, okay, it all checks out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, some of those wines, you know, you talk about, I mean, they take some time to come into their own. You got to put them on, mm-hmm. you know, weigh them down. But Barolo, that's a really interesting place to talk about where people did buck a trend, but they bucked it, you know, we get into this in some too, but they bucked a trend to make things bigger, make it juicier, yeah. make it, you know, and look, it's tough because having this conversation, there's an inherent, like, you think one way is right or one way is wrong. And I mean, you and I both know as you go through this journey with wine, probably with food too, you change your opinion, then you come back and then you go a different way. And then I think like 10 or 15 minutes before you die, you settle into what you really like and then you die. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you kind of like
yeah.
go up and down. But a lot of these regions, like you talked about, you know, that are warmer places, and you think mm-hmm. the wines are going to be big, powerful, huge wines because they're from such a hot, often, you know, kind of a region. And then you find out that these wines can be made with finesse and low alcohol. And good examples would be like some Zinfandels grown in California in regions that you would typically think totally. are very strikingly big wines. And then you come across one or two producers that are doing field blends that are mostly Zinfandel, and you taste it and you're like, this is incredibly subtle and elegant. And but if you were to give that to somebody who's used to a big Zinfandel from California, mm-hmm. and they would be like, what is this? I don't even know what to do with this.
Like Zin's such a good example, right? Because I did a tasting with Joel Peterson one time. It was like a school auction thing. Anyway, he got these really cool old Ravenswoods out of the cellar, and they were like 12.5-13 alcohol from, you know, back in the 80s. And that, this was years ago, and it blew my mind. And that's why our Zin is usually about 12.5 because, uh-huh. and not because I'm shooting for 12.5, but because Zin goes through this very specific, as it ripens, it's very bright red fruit. And then it kind of moves into that luscious black fruit. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to pick it those in the red fruit. And then and it's a totally different wine. It almost tastes a little bit Gamay-like.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, it does have that like kind of, there's like a secondary fruit component on Zinfandel that's handled that way. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know how Gamay has that, I actually don't mean this in a bad way, but it's kind of got that like, I want to say it's almost like banana-y type thing. And I don't mean mm-hmm. the Beaujolais Nouveau thing. I mean like, mm-mm. like it's got this kind of like bready, banana-y. I'm trying to think how else I'd describe it, but there is something with Zinfandel where it kind of has this. And you know, I don't know how the hell there'd either be a ton of money in this, Steve, or none. So I'm going to pitch you an idea here.
Okay.
I want you to make a white Zinfandel, straight up make a white Zinfandel and make an amazing white Zinfandel. Because I had this one from Ridge, and I think you and I have talked about this off mic, but Ridge Vineyards did a white Zinfandel. Paul Draper did it in the 80s. I think this was in 86 or 87. It was aged that old and it was stupendous and it was very low alcohol. And they did it in the style that Ridge was doing all of their stuff at that time, like really restrained, really, mm-hmm. you know. And I just keep thinking to myself, if somebody could bring back White Zinfandel and even play on the kind of hilariousness of that name, because we all mm-hmm. know what White Zinfandel means. I mean, and mm-hmm. you know, you think about Franzi out of a box or something like that and what mm-hmm. you used to drink after church or something. But like, but this could be done in a way and probably not even be that expensive that could like reset the chips for Zinfandel. I love messing with trends, and I think it'd be hilarious if somebody made a really tasty kind of white Zinfandel that other winemakers actually would want to drink. So that's like my pitch to you at the end
nice
of this pod.
Okay. Like, all right.
It could be done. I know it can be.
Oh, totally. Oh my gosh. It's made for, well, obviously Zinfandel is a good rosé grape because there's a lot of white Zin and it tastes good. I mean, white Zin tastes good. It has yeah. really nice fruit, you know, it'd be interesting to take a different approach to it. So yeah, we need to do that. We need to get a good Zinfandel source because we take rosé seriously. So I'm not saying you don't want to use old vines to make a rosé, but I do like making red Zin out of old vines.
We should end this on probably one of the regions in the world that you and I are most passionate about. That is typecasted. Speaking of rosé, Provence.
Provence.
And that region with all of its rosé, which I love. I mean, I would say I probably drink more rosé more than any other wine. I drink a ton of yours. But Provence makes some of the world's great red wines too. And nobody, I don't think people talk about it very much.
No.
I
mean, who talks about aware of it? Great red wines from Provence. Yeah. So people are aware of it. You know, we mentioned Kermit. They bring in some great red wines from Provence. But boy, it's not talked about very much, right? And great white wines in Provence as well. And even and Provence is one of those cool areas areas to learn from, because there's a lot of really balanced wines, red wines out of Provence, and it's a warm growing region. And as regions warm up, you know, these warm regions that know how to handle heat are ones to look at to sort of, gain the experience so that we can deal with the changing climate.
Yeah, for me, so when I got engaged, the night of my engagement, I was in New Orleans and I ordered a bottle of Chateau Simon. Of course, this is many years ago. But Chateau Simon has become this kind of flagship for me in wines that I steer people towards, because they make a fantastic Asian rosé, but they also make a great white wine, which is a field blend, and then they make a red. And I mean, they're a very respected wine in Provence. I mean, this is like a Grand Cru level type place. And I think it's like a great starting point, because if you want to get a $50, $60, $70 bottle of wine that's at a really high level, I mean, you know, this is where I would start. But if you can get wines, especially if you're in France, for 14 euros that are red, that are outstanding in Provence. I mean, they like knock your socks off, but there'd never be enough money to export them to the United States. Yeah. Why would you do that when you can send 14 container truckload ships full of rosé? You know, it's
fight that uphill to get that wine taken seriously. That's the thing. That's why we had to do In Pursuit of Balance. In Pursuit of Balance, speaking of Raj, because California Pinot was typecast at being tasting like cherry cola, and it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. There's a lot of Pinot that isn't, and you know, but we had to start in. We had to do In Pursuit of Balance in order to share that message, and it was successful. Now people understand that there's multiple styles of Pinot in California that are legitimate expressions of California, and that's all you want. Then it's like, okay, great. People can choose what they like, but at least they know that there are options. And then if you choose to make options, you have a lane to work in. That's the key.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, I, for one, cannot wait to try your white Zinfandel. This is I'm very excited about this. All right. So back to Napa. To end this, what should people try of yours besides the Ribolla Gialla? If you want a Napa wine that will just completely take you in a place you never expected to have a wine from Napa, what should people try of yours?
Well, our Cabernet Sauvignon, because it's this throwback to Napa cabs from 30, 40 years ago. Herbal, red fruited, vibrant, bright, but ton of flavor, because it's Napa cab. It's always going to have a ton of flavor. And so it's a pretty cool time capsule, time machine ride.
That's great. I love it. Throw your website out. Where can people get your wines?
Mathiasen.com. Two T's and two S's.
Mathiasen.com. Steve, it's always an honor to have you on the podcast. I really adore the wines and your family and all of this. Makes this job
awesome.
Fun. All right.
Well, thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Steve Mathiasen, and I want to thank John Adams for producing this episode. I want to remind all of you, go to SomTV.com and check out the 2022 Napa Valley Vintage Report. We are taking a look at 2022's vintage with some of the great winemakers up there, and they're going to go through how it's shaping up. And for you collectors, this is like invaluable inside baseball. And then also, if you're a SomTV subscriber, February 23rd, you can stream Cup of Salvation with hours of bonus features. If you want to watch it right now, it's available to rent and buy at SomTV.com. All right, everybody, drink something nice, and we will talk soon.